Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am playing the second half of an interview I did with the, I don't even know what kind of adjective to use for Steve Binder, who has worked with, directed, produced, recorded, everybody. You can't think of anybody who is famous who Steve has not worked with. And in this, the second half of the interview, you will hear stories about Diana Ross, about Danny Kaye, about Elvis Presley, about Pee Wee Herman, about, well, stay tuned. Here come the show. Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering, finding, recovering, uncovering who you really are, and then becoming it. Maybe that sounds odd, who you really are. Aren't you who you really are? Well, maybe you already know. Maybe you already suspect that there are things about yourself which you are keeping hidden. And not only from everybody else, but from yourself as well. I'm a psychotherapist. I've been practicing that career for well over 30 years now. And I have seen over and over again, and not only in my practice with my patients, but in my own life and in the life of my friends, that things about ourselves, sometimes they sneak out when we're not really aware. We are not aware. That's really the clue here. Not the things that we keep from other people. We all keep secrets about ourselves. We're all shy or embarrassed about some things. I like to use the example of, you know, laughing at a joke you didn't really get. There are dozens of ways in which we finesse what we know and who we are. I know people who pretend to like a movie if other people say they did, and then they pretend not to like it if other people say they didn't, and they never say what they think. Sometimes I think they don't know what they think. So those are ways in which we are pretending to be somebody we're not, but we know it. Okay. None of us is so secure, right? Although I think that's the goal of life as well, to know that there's nothing wrong with you, because there can't be anything about you that isn't also true of the rest of us. But never mind that. What I'm about here is those things which we have kept a secret even from ourselves. How can that be? Well, we all have had experiences in our early life, our very early life, when we acted in a certain way or said a certain thing or thought a certain thing, and we got a response that scared us, embarrassed us, caused us to feel neglected or abandoned. Sometimes these things are intentional. A parent who themselves has no permission to get angry, for example, may shut down anger in a child. The first eruptions of childhood anger may come in for a really overextended response, yelling, sometimes hitting, or just ignoring or abandoning. This is not conscious or intentional. The parent themselves has no permission to express their anger, and so they find it scary or embarrassing or dangerous or evil, and so they shut it down in the child. So the child then comes to learn that anger is dangerous. It's going to cost love, and we can't really afford that. You know, if our parents don't like us, we're in danger of dying. So that child then begins the family way of being, the family MO, of not expressing anger. And that child grows up to believe that they are somebody who does not get angry, and also is quite judgmental and critical of other people who are angry or just afraid of them, and shies away from people who easily express their anger. The important piece of this is that that person is not someone who doesn't get angry. That is a person who does get angry, but has found a way to deny their anger even to themselves. So why is this important? Because that anger doesn't go away. It lives inside that person, and it finds a way to express itself in subtle or indirect, and sometimes we call this passive-aggressive ways. How does that happen? Well, you know. Anger, which is badly bottled up, can turn itself back on the person and cause illnesses, headaches, stomach aches, ulcers, back aches, spasms, just all kinds of bad stuff. Or the person can find ways unconsciously to punish the people who have made them angry, but not directly. So they're late, or they forget things they said they were going to do, or they make jokes. Oh, I was only teasing, kinds of jokes. The anger comes out in ways they cannot control, and quite often are detrimental either to the person themselves or to the relationships. So, of course, this is only one example of the ways in which we keep secrets about ourselves from ourselves, and how those secrets can be dangerous to us. So that's what this show is about, and usually I spend the first half of the show talking about other ways in which this can happen to us and what we can do about it. And then I usually spend the second half of the show playing an interview that I did with someone who makes their living or their life with an art. It's my Anatomy of an Artist interview series. And why do I do that? Because people who make their living or their life with an art at least in that area of their life, are exactly who they really are. Because we live in a culture that does not support artists unless they happen to be hugely successful. And so in order to dedicate your life to an art, it has to be who you really are. You have to have no choice. And when I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, you can hear it. You can hear what it sounds like to be really, sincerely, completely who you are. And it is my hope that when you hear that, the part of you that has been hiding will jump up and down and say, me, 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 see me. See my anger, see my joy, see my creativity, see my silliness. See me, see what there is about me that you have been denied. So today I am playing the second half of an interview with the amazing Steve Binder. And so because the interview was so long, last week's show was entirely the first part, and this week's show is entirely the second part. This interview picks up where the last one left off. I'm playing actually the last part of the first half of the interview where I ended last week, where Steve is talking about directing the Tammy Show, which he says, and of course it's true, is one of the greatest rock and roll shows ever done. In the top 10, or as he says, maybe even the top 5 rock and roll shows ever done. And he explains, and you'll hear him talking about it, that the reason this is so is because he had, as youngsters, remember this is in the 60s, Chuck Berry, Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross and the Supremes, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, James Brown, just all on stage at the same time, right? And following his talking about the Tammy Show, he talks about Danny Kaye and the really funny, although not so funny for Steve at the time, experience that he had there. And following that, there are stories about Diana Ross, Pee-wee's Playhouse, perhaps you remember that. His trying to pull together and fixing the Star Wars holiday special, the experience with doing a show with Petula Clark and Harry Belafonte, where Petula reaches out during a duet and touches Harry Belafonte's arm, and how Steve had to fight to keep that in, and how they broke the color line in that show. And then, of course, there is the show for which he will always be known, and that is the directing of the Elvis Presley comeback special, and what he had to do to create what he created there, and the tug of war with Captain Parker. Was it Captain? Mm-hmm. But more than anything else, when you listen to Steve, and we talk about this at the very end of the interview, you're talking about passion. You're talking about the commitment, the attachment, the involvement, the enmeshment. He talks about learning from every experience, the good ones and the bad ones. It's the feeling that he's so deeply in his own life that there's nothing else he could have done with this life, even though if you heard the first interview, you heard the remarkably ironic way he got into this without really any particular thought on his own. So, listening to Steve Binder is listening to a man who is 100% himself. And at the end, you'll hear we both have to stop. We've been talking for well over an hour, and we agree that we can do it again. He's so generous that he offers to do it again. And I'm hopeful that at some point I will. But until I do, listening to this is beyond a treat. And you get an opportunity to have that treat right now.
I shot it at the Santa Monica Civic. If you can believe it, and this is 1963, using most of my Steve Allen technical crew, I think I only had 4 cameras to shoot it. But to this day, it is considered for sure in the top 10, if not the top 5, greatest rock and roll films ever made. And basically because, unbeknownst to any of us, and nobody can take credit for this except maybe the musical director, Jack Nitzsche, who suggested the talent for Bill to put into this movie. The cast was, and they were all basically youngsters at the time, was Chuck Berry, Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross and the Supremes, the Rolling Stones, James Brown and the Flames, Leslie Gore, Billy J. Kramer, the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, all on stage filming at the same time.
You're kidding.
No. I mean, Tammy Show is historical. I mean, it's still considered one of the great films. The James Brown performance and the Mick Jagger Stones performance are classics. But that led me to say I want to do films instead of television. Mm-hmm. And I partnered up at the time because I realized there was a fusion happening that most people in the music business were in the music business. People who were in the film business were in the film business, and television people were in the television business. None of them spoke to each other, and there was a sort of a caste system of who's really important in the entertainment industry. The music people basically were the low end of the totem pole. They were considered, you know, they weren't invited to the to the parties in the more esteem.
Right,
you know,
the A-list parties, right.
Exactly. And I felt it was just a matter of time until music and pictures would find their togetherness. I sought out a record producer who I had met named Bones Howe. Bones had been an engineer for Lou Adler. Lou was famous for Carole King. Lou, a lot of people would know because he was the producer of the Rocky Horror movie. And Bones was very well educated in engineering. He had a degree from a prestigious school. He was very quiet. I really liked him from the minute we met. And I sat down with him and said, Bones, I think we should partner up because I think, you know, television people don't think of television as an audio media. They just basically think because the speakers are so small that, you know, people are only watching the pictures. I happen to totally disagree with that philosophy. And on the other end of the spectrum is that nobody's really paying attention to how powerful and how fast the music industry is growing. So I think if there were two partners who represented both worlds, we could really make some noise. So we decided we'd go into partnership, and we created the Binder Howe Company. And the first project I was, in 1965, I left an important piece of this puzzle out. I went to New York to direct Hullabaloo, which was the first major network, quote-unquote, rock and roll show in prime time. ABC had already launched a West Coast primetime show called Shindig. Mm-hmm. And so this was NBC's answer to ABC. And Shindig got its name, interestingly enough, because an English producer named Jack Good, who had a very successful rock and roll show happening in England, was hired by ABC to come out and do a country western pilot, which he called Shindig. And when ABC realized that America wasn't really embracing country western in prime time, they told them, well, you know, why don't you do the show you're doing in England, which is more rock and roll oriented, which is what he did, and that they kept the title of Shindig, and, you know, and they did the Shindig series, which was very successful. When I got to New York to do Hullabaloo, and especially having just done the Tammy Show movie, I realized, though it had incredible talent behind the scenes, Gary Smith of Smith Hemion was the producer, Pepe at Nailsworth, who were Canadian performer writers, were on the writing staff. They went on to create a show called Hee-Haw eventually. Peter Matz was the musical director who had just completed the first Streisand album. Billy Goldenberg, who was the dance arranger on Hullabaloo, did the Elvis Presley special, comeback special with me, and did all the arrangements and did the conducting, and so forth. So there was a lot of talent that was being congregated for that. But the first show pilot was basically, you know, by my standards, not rock and roll at all. We had a New York high school marching band. It was done in New York. We had Don Adams coming on doing a stand-up comedy routine on sports about selling peanuts, but giving a prep talk like you thought he was talking to athletes in a locker room in the middle of the game. He was actually talking to vendors selling peanuts and popcorn. Things like that, which I felt were pretty hokey and not, didn't belong on the show. Mm-hmm. I was a big fan of the opening of the Whiskey A Go-Go and the girls in the cages. Mm-hmm. And I had just worked with a wonderful choreographer, David Winters, who was the hot guy in town. I insisted that, you know, he come along with me to New York to choreograph the Hullabaloo dancers. And we put up, the girls in the cages in one of the sets. I brought in, some of those beautiful models from the top model agencies to sort of be living statues in some of the rock and roll scenes to kind of represent the, I should have explained this to the public before I did it because a lot of people never got it, but it was to represent kind of the adult looking at the kids in this passive, stone-faced look, etc., but they were absolutely gorgeous females. But these became signatures of Hullabaloo and caught on. And we had every week a different host on the show. It would be Paul Anka one week and Sammy Davis another week and George Hamilton another week and so forth. So from a pure rock and roll standpoint, it was, television's answer to rock and roll. But we were very, very successful. And I did the, I signed a contract to stay there for 13 weeks. And I got a call from my agent in the middle of it saying that Danny Kaye wanted me to direct his series on CBS. Well, when I was 5 years old, I was standing in line with my parents to go see Up in Arms or one of the great Danny Kaye movies. And I couldn't believe, this idol of mine was offering me a job. And Danny had... what I didn't know behind the scenes is that Danny, the first year went on the air, was a huge success, won all kinds of Emmy Awards. But after that, the show started to deteriorate in the ratings. CBS was kind of, thinking about canceling the show, etc., and they decided it needed some new blood. This I did not know. So the producer that they brought in to do the Danny Kaye show was... had very little or no experience in producing other than game shows, but very personable. And the director who I replaced had basically, was going to, either he was going to leave the show or he's going to be in some executive capacity. And so when I came in to the show, after I had finished doing the Hullabaloo show, I was all, fired up, ready to do this incredible show with this incredible talent. Well, Danny and I ended up being like oil and water. I mean, we just didn't make it. And I have a lot of reasons for feeling the way I feel, but it was the first experience of being fired by anybody. What happened was that we had a few confrontations. And in television, a lot of times it's just all about getting along with people. It isn't so much about, bringing some creative ideas to the table, at least in those days, and variety and so forth. And I wanted to take the show out of the studio. We were shooting at Beverly and Fairfax on a stage, And I felt, you know, when I did some of the music numbers, it was a wonderful opportunity to go out on location and shoot some of these, which I did. And Danny thought it was a terrible idea. But the reviewers liked it a lot, and the public liked it a lot. And so Danny agreed he would go out and do a number with me. And I was, up until then, doing it with the guest stars, as opposed to Danny. And so this one particular number we did was with Shirley Jones. And Shirley was pregnant at the time, and she was fantastic. And we took the poems, What is a Boy, What is a Girl, you know, Sugar and Spice, Everything Nice, etc., and we put it to music. And Shirley would do the, you know, What is a Girl, and Danny would do What is a Boy. And so all morning, we shot it up in Griffith Park in the Hollywood on location. And I felt I'd shoot Shirley in the morning, and then after lunch we'd shoot Danny. So by the time Danny got there, all he had to do was do the song. We'd have all our camera positions, and everybody would know, because we were going to shoot them both the exact same way, technically. And Danny showed up, and he was sort of grumbling that he had to be forced to drive to Hollywood to do this segment. And Shirley was, you know, her agent and her managers were going nuts because she's pregnant, Steve. How can you do so many takes? And so was Shirley saying more and more. Mm-hmm. You know, she was great. So the crew had lunch, and Danny shows up with his manager. And I explained to him the camera positions, and I said, let's just do a run-through, and then we'll tape it. He said, okay. So technically, it was perfect. Danny's performance sucked. To be honest with you, because he really didn't know the words that well, you know, when he was supposed to be mimicking a giraffe, he was doing a monkey. When he's supposed to be doing a monkey, he was doing a bear, and so forth. So it was kind of out of, you know, he had to learn the material better. And so we finished the take, and I had gotten into the habit, especially with Steve Allen, of tape is cheap. So I would record everything, rehearsals, and, you know, I just felt, why not put it down, right. Unless you have, you know, a guide, if nothing else. And thank God in this case I did, because when I said, okay, now let's get ready to take the real one, you know, we went over the material again. I go back into the control room, and one of the cameramen said, Steve, I think you should look at camera three. I looked over at camera three, and the cameraman is patting Danny, walking to his car and leaving. So we aired the original, one letter of a complaint from the public. Then I went to his manager and I said, look, you know, I know Danny, you know, for whatever reasons is uncooperative, doesn't like going out there, so I won't ask him to do anymore. I'll just shoot it with the talent. And there was a case in the front office where they wanted me to get rid of Dionne Warwick on one of the shows and buy her off so they could put somebody they liked into who was appearing at, I think one of the major executives at CBS was friends with David Shine, who owned the Ambassador Hotel, who had a female singer in there that they wanted to put on the show, and so forth, and I refused, saying I wasn't going to do it. And so there was a few things going on behind the scenes that were not working. And my contract with Danny called for, I think, 9 shows. We're in like the 6th or 7th show. And I got a call from New York from Sammy Davis. And he said, hey, I just sold my series to NBC. I want you to come and produce and direct it. And I said, well, I have to get out of my, I have 2 more shows to do with Danny Kaye, but it's not really working great, so I need to get out of my contract. I don't think it'll be a problem. You know? So he said, okay, well, I need to make a decision because, you know, we're going to go right into pre-production and so forth. I said, I'll call you back. So I went to Danny's manager, who I liked a lot, and Herb Bonus, and I said, Herb, it's not working, I know it's not working. You know, I would give Danny direction, and he would basically ignore what I said, you know. And so I said, I have a chance to go do another show. Would you let me out of my contract? He said, well, let me talk to Danny. And he came back, and he said, I spoke to Danny, and the answer is no.
He just wanted to screw you.
So I called Sammy and I said, Sammy, I'm free the minute I finish Danny, but I've got two more weeks of shows. And the ninth show was the one I was really looking forward to doing in the very beginning, because it was a two-man show between Harry Belafonte and Danny. And Sammy said, you know, I would love to wait for you, Steve, but I'm under a lot of pressure and I got to make a decision right now. I said, I understand, I'm sorry. Hang up the phone, finish show eight in the dressing room. After the show, Herb Bonus comes in. He says, I don't know how to tell you this, Steve, but you don't have to come to work next week. Danny's giving you a release. Well, I lost the Sammy Davis show by this time and didn't get to do the Harry Belafonte segment. Now, I think it was less than a year later, I get a telephone call from Herb Bonus saying, would you be interested in getting into a partnership with Danny and his Dina Productions? I appreciate the call, but you got to be joking. But that show business.
Yeah, right.
So from Danny, and now I had nothing planned, and Bones and I were together, and Bones was the exclusive producer to all the hit records for the Fifth Dimension, the Association. We just started recording Laura Nero, and so we were a pretty hot company. And one of the artists that Bones was recording was Leslie Uggams, mm-hmm. for Atlantic Records, with Ahmet Erekat and Jerry Wexler. And lo and behold, I got a call from NBC in New York saying, would you be interested in, Leslie is starring on Broadway in a show called Hallelujah Baby. Would you be interested in doing a special with her on NBC? So I jumped at it and gathered up a group of people from Hullabaloo that I had worked with, a few on the West Coast that I had worked with. David Winters is one, Tony Basil was another one, etc. He was a wonderful, Tony worked with Bette Midler now, had her own hit record a few years back called, I think it was Mickey's or something of that nature, but Tony is an incredible dancer, choreographer, you know, performer. Billy Goldenberg, Earl Brown, who was a fantastic choral director, and I put together this team. Gene McAvoy, who did art direction on some of my shows, who did the Judy series, Judy Garland series, mm-hmm. for CBS, who was an assistant to Gary Smith. Mm-hmm. And we went to New York to do the Leslie Uggams special. We called it Hallelujah Leslie instead of Hallelujah Baby. And it was the beginning of what I discovered is something I really enjoyed doing, which is to custom make a special for a specific talent that if they couldn't do it or didn't show up, we'd have to throw it away because nobody else could just step in and do that show. It came generically from their own, you know, music, and it was something that was, you know, I compared it to a tailor making a custom-made suit. You know, you can't just go find somebody else to wear the suit after you've made it for a specific person. And that was a great experience. We really worked well together. We took off our titles as producer, director, writer, whatever, and we just sat in a room and we woodshed ideas. And the original ideas that you normally come up with for a special are the first ideas that get thrown out after you dig deep and go under the surface. And so immediately after I had done Leslie Uggams, Bones did the soundtrack for us and did the engineering on it. And that was a time when the network was very resistant to let outsiders in other than their own staffs. So I was trying to marry my world and the world outside of TV with the world inside of TV. And for a long time and many years after, I was putting a concert lighting designer with a television lighting designer to work as a team. Same with audio, where we have audio guys in the record business collaborating with audio guys who are used to just basically opening up microphones on stage and so forth. And ABC had just made a deal with, there was a big hit record with Nancy Sinatra called Boots.
Made for walking,
Billy Strange. And they had sold a show to Plymouth Automobiles to sponsor a one-hour primetime special for Nancy. At the very last minute, Nancy's agents made a better deal with what was a company, I don't even know if they're in business anymore, Royal Crown Cola. And they paid more money for the license fee, so Nancy's agent made that deal, and now they were stuck because they didn't have any talent to sell to Plymouth, who had already committed to doing this special. They went to Greg Garrison, the Dean Martin producer-director, and put him in to do the Petula. Basically, they approached Petula Clark. Petula had one hit record out of England called Downtown.
Yeah.
And so they were trying to convince Plymouth that she would be just as good as Nancy Sinatra. Well, Plymouth was very resistant to this. They didn't really feel Petula had public awareness in the United States. She wasn't as famous as Nancy Sinatra, etc. So to begin with, it was shaky. And it got compounded when Greg Garrison and Petula Clark didn't hit it off. So I got a call, as soon as I finished Leslie Uggams, from Petula Clark's agency, saying, you know, we need you. We need you to go to Megève, Switzerland, where Petula is.
And fix this.
And because now she doesn't want to do the special and she doesn't want to come to the United States. So we want you to fly over there and meet with her and convince her to come, and you can be the producer-director. So I did. I flew out, and in 48 hours, I was in Megève, Switzerland, back to the United States. And Petula and I met for lunch, and I had two suitcases, one with the ideas and another with my clothes. And thank God, the clothes went to Cairo, Egypt, and I still had my suitcase to have my meeting. What happened before I left is the agency gave me what they had sold Plymouth. And to me, it was dribble. It was just strictly pedestrian. You know, it was like take a piece of this show and a piece of that show and put them all together, and they look okay on paper, but there's no show there.
And so, certainly there isn't what you now know you can do, which is tailor make it for her.
Well, especially after I'd done Leslie Uggams, I knew exactly what I was going to do if I did it. And I went over and Petula said, I read the paper, I said, well, forget it. You can throw that away. And she said, good. And I said, you know, I explained that I had this team around me now that I was building on, and that we would come up with a, you know, a show that was hers. And we did. We created a Petula special. And I hired Alan Bly to be one of the writers. Alan and his partner at that time was Mason Williams, who worked on the Smothers Brothers show later. Mason was really brilliant. Not necessarily a television writer, but brilliant ideas, brilliant concepts, etc. And he was... I could go on and on about Mason, etc. But that was Alan's partner. I liked Alan very much. Alan was from Canada. He had a lot of great writing credentials, and so I hired the two of them. We bought all of Petula's records, and we found all these, you know, and found out she had written a slew of great songs with Tony Hatch in England. Plus, she'd written by herself some really nice songs. So we designed a show. We took her song, The Grass Is Always Greener, and made it, that's the A theme, where everybody thinks everybody else's life is better than their own, or their jobs are better, or whatever. And our concept is, you know, when you get through all of that, you realize, you know, you should be satisfied with what you have and what you do, and so forth. And we made a bunch of B themes within the main theme. And when we finished it, I had decided that we had only room for one guest star. And who's the guest star that I wanted to work with? Harry Belafonte. I didn't know Harry from Adam. I called him up cold in New York, never expecting him to answer his own phone, but he did. Introduced myself, told him I was doing Petula Clark special, and he said, "Who's she?" And I explained what I was doing, and he said, "No, Steve, the truth of the matter is I just don't do television except on rare occasions and so forth." And I said, "Well, I almost directed you when I was doing Danny Kaye, you know." So Harry called me back after he turned me down, mm-hmm. and he said, "Is Petula that blonde, blue-eyed girl from England who sings downtown?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I've been thinking about it, and I think we'd make a good combination, providing I get to, you know, do something I want to do on the show." I said, "No problem." So we did the special. There was a lot of confrontations among the sponsor, not Plymouth, but somebody who worked at Plymouth, who's in charge of advertising or the show, was a racist.
Yeah.
And he tried to get Belafonte taken out of the show. And to make a long story short is, in one of the production numbers, Petula, it's like what just went on now with our president's wife touching
the queen
and the queen touching her. We had an incident where in the middle of a song, Petula reaches over and touches Harry's forearm, and the guy in the control room representing Plymouth goes bonkers. So he literally, you know, threw a fit, wanted it taken out of the show. I had decided no way is that going to be taken out of the show, and erased all the other outtakes, so they had no choice but to air it. And it broke the color line in primetime television.
Yeah.
It was the first time that a black and a white person actually touched each other in primetime variety television. That triggered the Elvis Presley special, because the next call I got was from NBC asking if I was available to produce and direct Elvis. A quick story behind the scenes is that Colonel Parker made a deal with Tom Sarnoff at NBC at a party to make this special and for NBC to finance his next movie, which was A Change of Habit, I think. And everybody was all, you know, signed, sealed, and delivered except Elvis. Because what I heard from Bob Finkel, who was the executive producer on the special, is that Elvis was balking at doing this special, even though the Colonel had made the deal. So they needed to find somebody that he could relate to, that he respected. And they had read about my Harry Belafonte Petula Clark show and the incident that happened, and I stood up to the network and the sponsor. And so that began my adventure of, you know, my next wall was Colonel Parker, you know. And I just read a book that is fantastic, which was called The Last Lecture, which is a bestseller about a young professor who died at the age of 48 of cancer. But he wrote a book about his life, and one of his concepts was that we all face these walls, and whether we get through them or not depends on how much passion we have to follow through, to get over the wall or get through the wall. And I believe that very much, especially in my career, because I've always seemed to have run into person or a network or a sponsor or whatever, there always seems to be a wall in almost every production that you just have to fight through without being so confrontational.
If you destroy it.
Yeah, exactly. And this was one of those times where, you know, the Colonel wanted 20 Christmas songs. I wanted to do another tailor-made special for Elvis that nobody else could do. And as it turned out, it, you know, 40 years later, we're still talking about it and watching it, and et cetera. And then from there, I've just had, you know, so many opportunities to do interesting projects from I directed James Whitmore and Give 'Em Hell Harry, which is very relevant
so
to politics
oh
today, et cetera. And, you know, my relationship over the many, many years, going back to the Tammy movie with Diana Ross, and with all that's written about Diana, I have just a fantastic relationship with her. We've had great success doing Central Park in the rain to, you know, going to Wembley Stadium in England and doing a great HBO special and so forth. And it's been a real trusting relationship where she gives 110%. I mean, once she's into a production, you get, you know, 110% of her caring about it, caring about, you know, the quality of it, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not to say that at times we don't have our normal, as humans do, you have certain specific confrontations that happen, but you have to be really strong, you know, and she respects that. I think most artists do. I think when artists get really insecure, it's because they don't trust the people that are around.
That they're working with, yeah. I'm sure that's right.
And then, you know, it kind of leads me up to Pee-wee's Playhouse, where I was executive producer, and as quirky and as...
flawed.
You know, as it was one of the most creative experiences of working with a mixture of professionals and amateurs, and, you know, Ruben's eccentricities himself and so forth, but all in all, it was a learning experience. Everything I've done has been a learning experience. You know, I did the, it's funny, it's resurfacing now, but I became a fireman when I came in to put out the fires when they started production on George Lucas's Star Wars Holiday Special, which was a 2-hour CBS special with all the cast of Star Wars after the first movie came out, which now is, you know, it's incredibly, it's fun to read the people's comments on the special. But in reality, it was a great experience working with all those people. It was never meant to be a Star Wars movie. It was strictly a case of George wanted to sell toys to kids, and getting on television promoting that was his way. But
it was a marketing tool.
It was absolutely. But the fact is, you know, to go in and with a top-notch crew and that cast and pull together something that was a total disaster after the first week. They shut down the production. They were going to just, you know, bite the bullet. And when I was approached to see if I could pull it back together again and do it, I enjoyed the experience and I learned something from it. And I think that's the key to anything in life, whether it's positive or negative, is you've got to learn something from it.
Don't you think that it's in the learner? I mean, that if there's, some people learn and other people don't. I mean, some people are open to what there is to learn in the situation.
Well, I find, you know, if I hired, I've been teaching at the university a directing course for years and years. And, you know, the one thing I tell all my students is if I'm in a production and I hire, you know, 3 or 30 gophers to run around and go for errands and coffee and what have you, instantly you can tell the one, you know, maybe two that are going to really succeed, and the rest of them are just, you know, punching the clock. They're punching the clock, they can't wait till they get off, right. And, you know, they barely get their job done.
It's that same thing about passion, isn't it? Not about how much you're willing to give to the thing.
My biography, since I began in this business, is my last line is, you know, passion is everything.
Passion is everything. There's a line in one of my songs that says, you know, a life devoid of passion never would suffice.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think that that's so glaringly clear in everything you say. I mean, you can still, even when you're talking about stuff you did 50 years ago, the passion for it is still there.
Well, it was, to me, it's never been a job. The only reason I stayed in this business is because I woke up one day and said, you know, I hate getting off work because I have nothing to do. I can't wait to get up and go back to work. Yeah. Now, that has its pluses and minuses.
No,
you know, there's certain things that every artist, you know, suffers in that balancing act between family and work. But for me, you know, when they say, what are your hobbies? I'm living my hobby. I mean, I love to hear music. I love to work with artists. I mean, I love, you know, just being a part of the team. That's the one thing that I find when I'm not working that I miss.
The collaboration.
The family.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's the other thing that's so clear about you too. And I think in its way kind of unusual, because so many people who go into any of the entertainment fields are more interested in their own stardom than they are in the collaboration. They may have to collaborate. They may even be fairly good at it, but it's not their primary goal, and it does sound to me like it is for you.
It positively is. I've seen productions fall on their face because they hired the wrong cue card person, or, I mean, everybody is important.
Is important to
make it happen.
Do you want to answer your phone? Okay, so I guess we both have to go. So I just want to say thank you to you again and again.
Any time. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, we could. No, I'm
yes,
serious.
I know. Okay, so maybe we'll do it again.
Continue it. We could do it on the phone. I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
We'll, you know, so.
Well, we'll continue the relationship.
The Chevy Chase story is an incredible story. You know.
So we'll just do this again.
Yeah. Okay.
You're so wonderful. I'm so grateful. Oh my God.
Okay, Lynn.
So, okay. Did you hear it? Did you hear the passion, the commitment, the enmeshment, the joy, the, I don't know, the complete attachment to the thing he does? Okay, we can't all work with Diana Ross and Elvis Presley and everybody, you know. We can't all be famous. We can't all have lives that are documented so that the rest of the world can hear them forever. We can't all shoot rock and roll shows that 40 or 50 years later people are still going to be watching. Okay, fine. But we can all have what Steve has. We can all have ourselves. And that's the challenge. That's the challenge of, I believe, my own life. The work I do as a psychotherapist, trying to help other people accept that challenge in their life. It's the challenge of this show, and I believe it's the challenge of your life. To stop asking, what did I have to do? Who did I have to be? Who do I have to please? What will happen if they don't like it? What will happen if they know really who I am? What will happen if I know who I really am? To stop and just ask, what is it that really turns me on? What is it that when I'm doing it, time doesn't exist? What is it that when I'm doing it, I am it? And, you know, it can be playing ball. It can be knitting or crocheting. It can be sketching. It can be playing with children. It can be walking on the beach or in the mountains or in the forest. It can be grooming a dog. It can be writing. And what's really important about this, all the things that it could be, is that it doesn't have to be good, whatever that means. It doesn't have to be approved of. It doesn't have to get credit for you. It doesn't have to make money. Other people don't have to like it. I know that you know that some of the most famous, most respected artists, writers, musicians were not appreciated in their lives. Their works that are still being played hundreds of years later and sold for millions of dollars hundreds of years later, they died paupers because the people of their time didn't get it. But it didn't stop them because they were it, because they had to do it. So, sketch, but don't show anybody if you don't want to. Write, but don't read it to anybody if you don't want to. Be silly. Be aggressive. Be quiet. Be who you are. Well, it's a something of a lecture, isn't it? Before I end the show, I want to, as I quite always do, thank the remarkable and without whom you know what, Josh Hackney, who is my IT guy, who will be here in a day to help me make this show sound as good as it can possibly sound, and help me figure out why the things that I have been able to do for a year now, and certainly know how to do, are no longer working. And it's almost certainly something I'm not doing right, but Josh will know what it is, and he will fix it and show me how to do it right. Oh, yes, I know what I wanted to say. I don't remember whether I gave my website or any of that in this show, so here it is. You can find Josh, and you can also find me at thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. There's a link for email me on the website. There are also old podcasts, although not the most recent ones, because I'm working on the, well, I'm not working on the website, but the website is being worked on. So sometime in the near future, they'll all be up there. Okay, so if you want me, or you want Josh, or you want to find out more about Steve, email me. Okay. As always, I hope that you got something you can use in this show, something that interested you, something you didn't know, something you were glad to have heard, something that will bring you back. Because as you know, I will be here next week, same time, same station. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten